thanks for the invitation to come here by Rob Myers. Tomorrow, I should apologize for the string theorists in the audience. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about ADS-CFT and non-equilibrium dynamics that are kind of coming much more from the string theory side. Today's talk is going to be much more motivated from condensed matter physics, but what I'll try and do is I'll give you a kind of little bit of a prequel and a sequel to what I'm going to talk about tomorrow. Which indicates some kind of ongoing projects related to non-equilibrium charge transport using ADS-CFT that I believe is potentially related to some of what I'll describe in relation to topological systems. Okay. So the outline of the talk is I'll give some motivation for this particular problem coming from cold atoms, and I'll give you an overview of a very paradigmatic model known as the Haldane model, which in many respects actually had its origins in high energy physics, okay? So Haldane was interested in some recent work of Gordon Semenoff at the time in relation to the parity anomaly, and he was trying to think of a condensed matter analog of this effect. And very recently, this model has been realized in cold atoms. And this opens up a whole range of possibilities for tuning topological states of matter, not just in 2+1 dimensions, as I'll discuss here, but also potentially in higher dimensions. And so since many of these topological states have gapless surface states, I think there are some directions for looking at non-equilibrium dynamics of the boundary theories in these kind of topological problems. So what I'm going to describe is some recent work done with my graduate student Marcello Caio and Nigel Cooper in Cambridge on the non-equilibrium dynamics of the Haldane model. Okay, it forms an example of what is known as a Chern insulator. And in particular, we were motivated to ask a question about what happens if you quench between topological and non-topological phases. Okay, and I'll try and explain why that's potentially an interesting question to look at. And as I said, if I've got time, I'll try and kind of allude to what we're currently working on with Conrad Sharm and Andy Lucas in relation to holographic constructions far from equilibrium. Okay. So just to kind of make sure everyone's on the same page, I mean, although there's been kind of huge amount of work on topological insulators over the last few years in condensed matter physics, the holy grail of topological systems in condensed matter are still simple quantum Hall systems. And if you look at behavior of 2D electrons in a strong magnetic field, then at very low temperatures in millikelvin regime, you see that the Hall resistance, instead of having some linear dependence on the magnetic field, gets these very robust plateaus, which in the integer case occur at integral multiples of E squared upon H, whereas in the fractional regime, they occur at some rational multiples of this fundamental unit of conduction, okay? So this robust quantization is a very strong hint that this is topological. And since the discovery of the fractional quantum Hall effect, there's been a kind of huge amount of work on trying to understand the topological characteristics of these two-dimensional systems. Okay, and to understand the integer quantum Hall effect, you essentially, it's a kind of single particle problem interacting with some disorder potential, whereas to understand the behavior of non-trivial fractions, for example, here at filling fraction 1/3, you actually need to understand the role of interactions, okay? Now, what I'm going to talk about is the dynamics of this Haldane model, okay? This was a way to generate topological phases in a non-interacting system. So from the purpose of looking at the non-equilibrium dynamics, this makes it much easier to analyze. But there's probably a whole zoo of potential questions that you can ask about interacting systems. And again, this is the kind of place where holography might play a role. Okay. So just to kind of indicate, you know, kind of novel properties in these quantum Hall systems, you know, they've kind of been much studied over the last 20, 30 years because they display all sorts of exotic phenomena ranging from fractional charged excitations to non-trivial non-abelian statistics. But also for the purpose of this talk, they have non-trivial edge states. Okay, so a semi-classical qualitative way to think about these edge states is you can imagine you've got electrons in a strong magnetic field. They're executing very tight cyclotron orbits. As a result, they're not conducting in this region, so your bulk system is insulating. But on the boundary, you have terminated the cyclotron orbits, and so you have these skipping orbits, and you have some conduction along the boundaries. Okay, and What's particularly interesting in these systems, that at least in the fractional regime, the theory of these edge states is well understood. Okay, Wen was one of the first people to put forward the theory of these edge states, and it's described by a so-called chiral Luttinger liquid, which means you can understand the behavior of these edge states, and in particular tunneling properties between edge states in the quantum Hall regime. Okay. So if you like, if you know you are a holographer, this is a very simple example of a kind of bulk boundary correspondence, because it turns out there's a very intimate relationship between the wave functions in the interior of the sample, the gapped wave functions, and the conformal blocks that you would use to describe correlation functions in this critical theory. Okay, so another way to say this, if you want to maintain gauge invariance for Chern-Simons theory in a system with boundaries, then you automatically have the presence of these edge states. And in a sense, the kind of edge states talk to the bulk, and there's a kind of correspondence between 2D physics in the interior of the sample and 1D physics of the gapless boundary. Okay. So why would you look at the non-equilibrium dynamics of such a system? Well, over the last, say, 10 years or so, you know, there's been a huge amount of work looking at the non-equilibrium dynamics of strongly correlated systems. And I would say, broadly speaking, it's motivated by the fact that if you have some strongly interacting quantum system with emergent novel excitations, you've got a lot of rich behavior already in equilibrium. So if you try and drive these systems out of equilibrium, you've got the chance to have either more exotic physics, or at least try and understand something more about the behavior of these strongly correlated systems. Okay, so that's one kind of general motivation. Another reason is that, you know, a lot of the proposals for using topological systems are in relation to things like topological quantum computing, trying to use the robust characteristics of these states, non-abelian braiding, for example, that if you're going to perform manipulations on these types of systems, well, sure, you can do them adiabatically, but it's clear that in the future you might actually want to do operations very quickly on these systems if you're going to use them for computational purposes. So trying to understand the non-equilibrium behavior of topological systems is potentially useful from that perspective. A third reason is that, as I'll describe in the experiments realizing the cold atoms version of the Haldane model, actually a lot of work has been done to realize topological phases by starting from driven systems. Okay, so it seems a little bit paradoxical that if you're interested in an equilibrium system, you might create an equilibrium system by driving some time-dependent Hamiltonian. But there's actually a lot of work on so-called Floquet insulators, where indeed that's precisely what they're trying to do. So the logic is, if you drive a system out of equilibrium, you might get to some novel phase, and under certain circumstances, that novel phase could actually be a topological phase. Okay. So the question we want to ask then is, what happens to some of these topological systems if you drive them far from equilibrium? And it was motivated by a relatively simple question. Okay, if you start with a topological system and it has some gapless edge states, and you abruptly change the Hamiltonian so that your final Hamiltonian is no longer topological, what happens to the edge states? Okay, so on the one hand, you say, well, I've started with a topological system. It's supposed to be very robust to perturbations. So from a broad brushstrokes point of view, you might think nothing happens. On the other hand, your final Hamiltonian doesn't have edge states. And so the edge states can't be there in the final state. And so the question is, how does the topological character of the system resolve itself if you drive the system out of equilibrium? Okay. And so we managed to get a little bit of insight into this problem from the perspective of the Haldane model. And it could be that some of these things actually generalize into more complicated scenarios. Okay. So what is this Haldane model? Okay. So as I said, if you look at the title of this work, it's kind of not far off 30 years ago. It was a model for the quantum Hall effect without Landau levels, okay? So that was one of his motivations. Normally, you think about quantum Hall effect as occurring in the presence of a strong magnetic field. But Duncan was interested in a particular aspect of this problem, which was actually the fact that what's important in quantum Hall physics is not magnetic fields, but is the breaking of time reversal symmetry. And so what he wanted to do was to think of an example where you could show that you get a quantum Hall effect without a net magnetic field, but you nonetheless break time reversal symmetry. Okay? The second reason was that, you know, there was a lot of work done by Gordon Semenoff in particular on the so-called parity anomaly, and this example is actually some kind of condensed matter analog of this effect, okay? So what's useful, as I said, from our perspective, is that there's no interactions or disorder in this problem. It just describes spinless electrons, by which I mean spin-polarized electrons. So in the cold atoms experiments, they'll make fermions with different hyperfine levels, and they will just consider atoms in one of those hyperfine levels. So there's one species of fermion, so it's a spinless fermion. And they consider the problem on a honeycomb lattice. Okay, so why on earth would you start off considering it on a honeycomb lattice? Well, what was known for quite a long time was that if you look at electrons hopping on a honeycomb lattice, they have low energy hotspots where you're described by relativistic Dirac fermions. This is all of the kind of underlying physics related to graphene and the relativistic quantum Hall effect in graphene. And so what Duncan was interested in is the fact that if you look at electrons hopping on a honeycomb lattice, you have a natural low energy description in terms of gapless Dirac fermions, two species of Dirac fermions. And if you turn on perturbations, you're going to gap the spectrum, and so you have the ability to get into some kind of topological state. That's the kind of rough logic behind the proposal, okay? So what he recognized is that there's two distinct ways to gap this system. One is which you break the inversion symmetry of the lattice by making a distinction between the A and B sublattices of this honeycomb lattice. And what he recognized is if you introduce a potential onto these A and B sublattices, you gap the system, but you do so in a way that just generates a conventional semiconductor. So you imagine you've got two Dirac cones that meet in the absence of this perturbation. You turn on the perturbation, you gap the spectrum, you get a semiconductor. On the other hand, what he recognized is that if you want to try and simulate quantum Hall physics, you want to break time reversal invariance. And the way he does this is to thread this honeycomb lattice with some flux. So here he has some A, B, A, B, A, B. These are little fluxes that you imagine penetrating through this honeycomb lattice. And they're chosen in such a way that the flux through B is opposite to the flux through A. And that if you add up all of the fluxes in the interior of this hexagon, it's zero. So there's no net magnetic field, but you've nonetheless broken time reversal invariance because you've chosen a particular direction for either of these A or B fluxes. So if you imagine what happens to electrons if they're hopping through such a lattice, by the Aronoff-Bohm effect, they're going to pick up a phase when they enclose some flux, okay? So if you look at electrons, say, executing first neighbor hops, okay, going round this hexagon, there's no phase factor. But if you look at hopping to the next neighbors, they're going to enclose some net flux, and they're going to pick up a phase. Okay? So the model is very simple to write down. Spinless electrons hopping on a honeycomb lattice, nearest neighbor hopping and further neighbor hopping that has some complex phase, and you introduce an asymmetry between the A and B sublattices. Okay? That's the model. Okay, and I should just mention, just because there's been a lot of work in topological insulators, here we're talking about topological states of matter with broken time reversal symmetry. A lot of the recent work on topological insulators are actually time reversal symmetric, and the very famous Kane-Mailey model that was actually instrumental in the development of topological insulators can actually be regarded as two copies of this Haldane model with opposite fluxes for the two spin species. Okay, so here we're just thinking of a problem without spin and broken time reversal symmetry. Okay. So just to be explicit then, this is the Hamiltonian, nearest neighbor hopping and further neighbor hopping. We have this explicit phase factor that breaks time reversal symmetry, and we introduce this parameter capital M, which breaks the inversion symmetry of the lattice. Okay? And the idea is if you turn just this on, you're going to go to a normal semiconductor. If you turn this on, you're going to go, as I will show, to a topological phase. And the idea is that if you have both of these perturbations, you get a phase diagram that exhibits both of these phases. Okay. Okay. So as I mentioned, this has a low energy description in terms of Dirac fermions. So let's just be explicit about this. If you just go back to the previous Hamiltonian and imagine that these are perturbations to some simple type binding problem of electrons hopping on this lattice. If these are small, you can imagine linearizing the problem in the vicinity of the nodes in the Brillouin zone where you have these Dirac points. And so what you're going to wind up with is a low energy effective theory for these two independent K points that's of the form of a Dirac fermion. Okay, and so there's basically only two features that you have to kind of take note of. One is that there's an effective speed of light that depends on your microscopic parameters. Okay, it's not equal to one. Okay, we'll set it equal to one in various places, but in general, it's some effective speed of light that reflects the underlying lattice model. And in addition, your Dirac fermions have some effective masses, which are a combination of the explicit mass that you introduced to break the sublattice symmetry, and also the phase parameter phi that is going to break time reversal symmetry, okay? And so in general, if you break inversion symmetry or you turn on this time reversal symmetry breaking term, then you're gonna generate an effective mass for your Dirac fermions. So what does the phase diagram look like? So this is what it looks like. So this is turning on then inversion symmetry breaking. This is turning on these fluxes through the plaquettes of your hexagons. You see that you have normal regions here indicated by this parameter nu equals zero, which I'll return to in a moment. And you have these two phases that have an index plus or minus one, which are the two topological phases, okay? And so you see that if phi is equal to zero, and you just go through the middle of this diagram, you go indeed from a normal to a normal, there's no topological phase. On the other hand, if you turn off the inversion symmetry breaking and you just turn on this time reversal breaking field, you go through these two topological phases, okay? And so the connection to the parity anomaly was that if you ask, what are these phase boundaries, okay? They are precisely the two loci. Okay, this is one sinusoid, this is another, where those two masses, the effective masses of those Dirac fermions vanish, okay? So what it means is that if you sit on this boundary, okay, you've, in a sense, changed the symmetry between those two Dirac fermions. One is massless, the other is massive. And so you can start to then have realizations of theories of fermions with an odd number of species, and therefore realize the parity anomaly, okay? So that was the kind of logic for this proposal, okay? So what's interesting from our point of view is the fact that actually these phases are distinct, okay? You've got to bear in mind, although it looks a little bit artificial when you write down this problem, you've introduced these strange magnetic fluxes, actually as a point of principle, it's a very simple model. It's just spinless fermions with some magnetic net zero flux through the plaquette, but some time reversal symmetry breaking, and you're finding these distinct topological phases, okay? So how do you understand that? Well, the problem is, you know, when you're looking at band structure and you're looking at energy levels of electrons hopping on a lattice, you know, the natural tendency is to look at the energy spectrum, and the bands and the mass gaps tell you all the information, and in kind of kindergarten solid state physics, this is indeed the case, right? The problem with that is that if you were to look at, say, the Dirac Hamiltonian, you wouldn't just look at the eigenfunctions, you'd look at the eigenvectors as well. And what was missing, perhaps, in a lot of the kind of early band structure treatments is the fact that actually, if you look at not only the energy levels, but also the wave functions, they can encode some topological properties of your system, okay? So what you can think about is you can think about how your wave function changes in momentum space. So you imagine you've got some Brillouin zone, your electrons live in momentum space, but they're described by some Hamiltonian, okay, or they have some state psi, and there's a mapping from points in momentum space to the eigenvectors, okay? And in principle, whenever you have some mapping between two spaces, you can have winding, and the idea is that in this simple model, there is some non-trivial winding which distinguishes those two phases of the phase diagram, okay? So you can introduce a so-called Berry connection, which tells you about how the wave function varies from point to point. You can introduce a Berry curvature, which is a little bit like the analog of F mu nu. And if you integrate this curvature over the 2D Brillouin zone, the idea is that this is a topological invariant. And so if you evaluate this quantity in the non-trivial phases, you get plus or minus one. If you evaluate this in the semiconductor phases, the normal phases, this index is actually equal to zero, okay? So much of what you learn about kind of magnetic vector potentials and magnetic fields translates into this momentum space language, okay? It's as if there's a kind of magnetic field acting in momentum space, which is going to give you this non-trivial Hall effect. Okay. And what's interesting is that in these experiments, they can actually map out this Berry curvature, and they can see the effects of this effective magnetic field in momentum space. Okay. So just to kind of reinforce the point, for the Haldane model, this index is equal to plus or minus one or zero. Okay. This is consistent with the fact that in the integer quantum Hall effect, which you normally get in the absence of interactions, you don't have any non-trivial fractional powers, okay? So you get some integer multiple of e squared upon h as being your Hall response, okay? So that's fine. But if you try and understand where this comes from in the Dirac fermion language, it turns out that your individual Dirac points are contributing plus or minus a half. And if they come in with opposite sign, you end up with a trivial phase. If they come in with the same sign, you get a non-trivial topological phase, okay? And so this is going to be useful when we start thinking about what happens as you transit between phases, because the initial calculations we can do are going to be what happens if you flip the sign of the mass of a Dirac fermion, how do you change the topological characteristics? And that will give us some intuition for what to expect in the Haldane model, okay? Okay, so let me just to kind of make sure that the conventions are all specified. When I look at the problem on a strip, I mean, we're interested in the behavior of these topological phases. The behavior of these phases manifests themselves most clearly on a finite size strip, okay? So what we're gonna do is we're gonna take a section of this graphene lattice with N rows of atoms, okay, capital N, okay? In most of the simulations, N will be equal to 20, okay? Some will be done for N equals 30, N equals 40, but mainly it's N equals 20. And the idea is that we're going to look at the energy spectrum with this finite geometry and see that the behavior of the spectrum is different if you're in a topological versus a non-topological phase, okay? So here, we're just sat in a particular region of this phase diagram where this flux is set equal to pi over 6, and we're in a non-topological phase. And here you see that you have some filled energy levels, an energy gap, and this is just a normal insulator. When you sit in one of the topological phases, okay, you see that you've got these extra states that are in the band gap. These are your left and right moving edge states, okay, that you have in the quantum Hall effect. So you see this very straightforwardly by exact diagonalization of this Hamiltonian on a finite size strip, okay? So what we're going to be interested in then is, you know, if we do a quench between the normal phase and the topological phase, clearly there is a distinction between the energy level structure in these problems. So something has to change, right? On the other hand, we know that this is a topological system. So this churn index, if you like, as it's called, is some non-trivial integer that is quantized and is supposed to be robust to perturbations. And so what we're interested in is what actually happens in this kind of setup. Okay. So let me just give you kind of overview of how this model was realized experimentally. It's quite interesting. If you look at Duncan's original paper on this, he kind of indicates that he's regarding it as a toy model that probably won't ever be realized, okay? And actually, if you just look at the model on line one, actually it looks like, okay, it's an interesting cute example, but it's not gonna be experimentally realized. I think a lot of progress in cold atoms has made a lot of these toy models elevated to a status where actually they can be experimentally realized, and very simple conceptual ideas can actually be interrogated in quite a lot of experimental detail. So just to kind of give you a cartoon of what they do, you don't need all of the information on this diagram. Essentially, what they're trying to do is they're trying to make this hexagonal honeycomb lattice. So that's the first technical challenge, okay? So essentially, you're trying to combine laser beams in two orthogonal directions and make yourself some non-trivial lattice. So, okay, they can do this using various laser geometries, okay? The slightly harder part is what they have to do is they have to introduce the complex second neighbor hopping, which is much harder to do, okay? What you can think about is if you just imagine having some standing waves, so you put your atoms in some optical lattice, so you've just got two counterpropagating laser beams, they just sit inside this lattice, okay? The tunneling through that optical lattice potential, you know, clearly depends on how big your barrier is, okay? So there's some kind of tunneling amplitude through this barrier that determines what your hopping matrix elements are. So what they do is they jiggle, essentially, their optical lattice in the X and Y direction so that they're slightly out of phase with each other. And the idea is that by doing this, you actually modulate the second neighbor hopping so that it picks up a phase factor, okay? So quite literally, the phase that appears in this Haldane model that's breaking time reversal symmetry is actually generated by some little piezoelectric oscillators that introduce a relative phase shift between their lasers in their geometry, okay? So this is one example then of a time-dependent driven system that they're using to simulate an equilibrium Hamiltonian that has these complex phase factors, okay? So they can do this, and in particular, they can map out the phase diagram of this Haldane model by a variety of techniques, okay? So a relatively simple thing you can do is you can say, well, look, I mean, somehow what you've said in the analysis of the Haldane model is that you have two species of Dirac fermions. When the mass of these Dirac fermions goes to zero, you transit from this normal phase to this topological phase. So the obvious thing to do is, can you just measure these mass gaps in this cold atoms realization, okay? And so the way they do this is that they apply a magnetic field gradient to their sample. The fermionic atoms move under the action of this gradient, and as a result of kind of executing block oscillations as a result of this perturbation, some of the atoms get excited to the upper level. Okay, you imagine you've got some Dirac fermions, you've introduced a mass gap by splitting the degeneracy between those touching, and they apply a magnetic field gradient to excite some fermions to the upper band. Okay, what does that mean? It means that if you get a lot of fermions in the upper band, then you've got no mass gap. Okay, if you move away from this point by adding some perturbation, you reduce the number of fermions in the upper band. And so by measuring the number of fermions that are occupied, they can essentially measure the band gaps in the system. So this place here, where this asymmetry between the A and B sublattices is actually zero, they have a maximum that corresponds to the vanishing of the mass gap, okay? Similarly, they can do this not in the presence of this sublattice symmetry breaking term. They can also do this in the presence of this modulation between the laser beams, i.e. in the presence of this phase. And what they see is that this gap closes when the laser beams are 90 degrees out of phase. Okay, so this corresponds to the maximum gap and actually being in the topological phase. Okay, and so the idea is that if you use this kind of gap information, you can get the phase diagram. Okay, that's one thing, and I'll show you that in the next transparency. The other thing they can do, which is a little bit more convincing because that's just gaps, if you want to look at something topological, right, what I said is that this Berry connection that tells you how your wave functions change in momentum space has the analog of a kind of magnetic field in momentum space. What it says is that if you put your atoms in the system and let them execute a block oscillation in one direction, you should see some drift of the center of mass of the cloud in the transverse direction. So this is what they call the differential drift, okay? The differential, because what they do is they apply the gradient one way, see that the atoms shift in the transverse direction, they then reverse the field and see they go in the other, and they subtract the two signals because this actually gives them a little bit more resolving power. They can actually see the difference between the topological and the non-topological phases more easily. What you can see is that if they turn on this phase difference, okay, in one region of the phase diagram, there's a drift in the positive direction. In the other region, there's a drift in the other. So what it says is they can map out the presence of this Berry connection in momentum space and see the topological properties directly in these cold atom settings, okay? And so if you combine the data, this is the data that they get from the vanishing of the mass gaps, you can see that qualitatively it follows the form of the Haldane model. Yeah. Good question. So they've got order kind of 10 to the 5 atoms. Okay. So it's a 2D system, so kind of square root of 10 to the 5. It's kind of the size of the system. Right.
That's the effect of... Because they have a trap as well, right?
They've got a trap as well. Yeah. So...
They know like, the effective size of honeycomb lattice uniform.
I'd have to double check because you're right. Because, I mean, so just to kind of unpack the question, I mean, so to keep the atoms in the lattice, you've got to have a harmonic confining potential. That's not very interesting from the physics of the trap. So they have about 10 to the 5 atoms in the system. So, you know, this kind of square root of 10 to the 5 by 10 to the 5. But then as Will's asking, if you've got the trap as well, you want to kind of somehow mod out that effect. So, you know, let's say it's off by a factor of 2, right?
Because these give you the edge states to some extent.
Yeah, but yes and no. So, well, so, okay, no, that's a good question, actually. So what we're going to look at in the simulations is the role of the edge states. And actually, I don't know whether in their experiments I should regard it as an infinitely large system without edge states, or whether actually the effect of the trap is to act as a confining potential, which it clearly does. And so maybe they have edge states on this boundary. Okay, what I can say is they've not tried to resolve this structure, okay? And I think one of our kind of suggestions is actually there is some non-trivial physics on those edges. Whether or not they can see it, they need some local probes in their atomic setting, okay? So it's actually a good physical point, okay? So the subject about the Chern index, okay, is primarily in the infinite size system. You can happily have this topological state and examine it in the thermodynamic limit, but things become more transparent if you put it in a finite size geometry because indeed you have edge states, okay? So experimentally, I don't know whether or not they can actually see this, okay?
One more question.
Yeah?
How big is the energy gap in physical units?
Oh, blimey. So these are in kind of... I mean, physically in what sense? I mean, in kind of...
This is a gap versus...
I mean, they're measuring these in hertz, right? So what I'm showing here is this is the fraction of atoms in the second Brillouin zone, okay? So they've excited the carriers into the second band. So what you see is the two Dirac points in this example have their maxima in the same place, okay? So this corresponds to being, say, down here because they've not introduced this time reversal symmetry breaking. As you introduce this time reversal symmetry breaking, these two peaks separate, okay? So there's a frequency splitting in hertz, which is essentially set by their lattice parameters, okay? So they've got some optical wavelength, optical lattice, okay, has a certain kind of wavelength. They have their tunneling parameters that are determined by this, and so all of their kind of energy scales are measured few hundred hertz. And what you see is that they can see the splitting between those two Dirac points, which correspond to these green and orange curves. Okay, so they can see the separation of the clouds. Okay, so I'm not sure if that's so helpful. Right?
These scales are much greater than the effective temperature they have in the.
Yeah, but because the temperatures are kind of, you know, close to absolute zero. They're kind of nanokelvin. Right?
For monolithic systems, it's hard to cool them down. Right?
No, that's true. And actually, they make a point about this because one of the things they want to do is ultimately use these experiments to look at the problem in the presence of interactions. Okay, so in the interacting system, then indeed you're going to get some heating effects, and actually then that becomes much more of a worry. Okay, for this, they're essentially dealing with non-interacting fermions in kind of nanokelvin regime, and the error bars here. At least my understanding of them, is actually because they don't have a good characterization of their optical lattice because they're jiggling it, essentially, okay? So there's actually some errors associated with their lattice parameters, okay? That's not associated with heating, as I understand it, okay? So the temperature scales are much, much less than the gaps that are being induced by their perturbations. Okay, so then this is a map of this differential drift, and you can see that it's got the sign in one direction and the sign in the other. And so indeed, they can map out this Haldane phase diagram, at least with some large error bars in that case. Okay, so let's get on to the question we want to ask theoretically then, right? So we have this phase diagram, and we know that in this regime, we have these non-trivial edge states. Out here, we don't. And so the question is, what happens if you abruptly change the parameters of this Hamiltonian such that you transit between these two phases, okay? So in the language of these Dirac fermions, in this low energy description, what you're essentially doing is you're changing the sign of the mass of one of these Dirac fermions and, or changing the mass of one of these Dirac fermions, and what you're going to expect is you're going to promote carriers to this upper band, okay? Now, there's a separate question as to whether or not you can get away with a low energy description when you're doing a far from equilibrium response. So what we'll check is that the intuition we get out of the Dirac fermion actually matches what you get out of the Haldane model, okay? But actually, the Dirac fermion captures it. So what we're going to do is we're going to excite carriers to this upper band, and we're going to ask what happens to the churn index, okay? So it's a straightforward calculation because the Haldane model describes essentially free fermions. And so these Dirac fermions are just free fermions. So what do you want to do? You want to take your initial state and you want to decompose it in terms of eigenstates of the post-quench Hamiltonian. You know how these evolve as a function of time, and you just want to go through the mathematical machinery of working out the churn index for this state. Okay. So you get this expression. It involves the explicit coefficients in your superposition, and you see that, okay, it has the potential to be time dependent. The problem is, when you actually look at this in detail, what you find is that the coefficient in front of this time dependence only depends on these superposition coefficients evaluated at very large momenta, right? So what it says is we're doing this quench, we excite some carriers to the upper band, we wind up in some superposition of the post-quench Hamiltonian, and our churn index depends on those superposition coefficients. But because the churn index involves an integral over the whole Brillouin zone, it turns out that you only pick out the contributions at low momenta or at high momenta, and on physical grounds, you're not expecting to populate those high energy, high momentum modes post-quench, okay? And so if you actually do a computation, which I'll show in the next transparency, you can see that following a quench, this coefficient is essentially zero, this probability to be in the upper band at k equals infinity, which means you have no time dependence, okay? What it says is this churn index does not change following the quench. So you start in a topological phase, you go to a non-topological phase, and yet somehow this characteristic invariant hasn't changed. On the other hand, you know that your spectrum doesn't have edge states in one case, okay? So something has to give, okay? So this was just to show you explicitly, if you just consider a mass quench in the Dirac Hamiltonian, if you have a sign-preserving quench or a sign-changing quench, at this high momentum, you always end up with zero occupancy, okay? So that's why the time dependence disappears. In principle, there could be some change in the value of the churn index when you abruptly change the quench. But it turns out that actually, although there's a difference between the sign-preserving and sign-changing quench, actually that effect is compensated by the sign change in the mass, okay? Yeah.
Can you just go back to the last slide? I'm confused. Because the churn index is defined for a gapped spectrum, usually. In theory, you quench a system, so you excite a bunch of states, you have energy, density. Don't you have to be a bit careful how to define
yes.
the churn index?
Yes, very good.
Using like density matrix.
So, you see, formally, right? So
precisely. So there's multiple issues here, right? So the first thing we're doing is we're taking this index that had a well-defined status in the equilibrium problem. We excite to this new Hamiltonian, we compute that same quantity, and we see that that quantity is unchanged under unitary evolution, okay? There's a separate question as to what does that mean, and how does it impact the topological properties, okay? So let me kind of tell you qualitatively. I mean, this is a problem that I kind of discussed with Nigel Cooper a long time ago, okay? We were in Trieste having a coffee overlooking the Adriatico, and we kind of said, well, okay, I mean, somehow qualitatively, what you expect is that the currents are going to change in the system. Your conductivity is going to change. There's going to be some non-trivial evolution. But then my graduate student computed this churn index, and that quantity doesn't change. Okay, so you've immediately got a bit of a paradox here, right? So does it mean that the usual relationship between the conductivity and the churn index is different, out of equilibrium? That's one possibility. Could it be that just this quantity you're computing has no significance whatsoever? Okay, it's another possibility. So what we decided to do then is to try and interrogate this further by looking at what happens to the edges. Do they show any non-trivial dynamics, and can we get a feel for what's going on? Okay, because clearly something must change. Okay, so this was actually a bit of a surprise when we computed this, and in fact, a few months actually before we put our paper on the archive, Marcus Riegel actually put a very nice paper out where they referred to this as a no-go theorem. Okay. Because what they said is you start with this thing in a topological state, you quench to a non-topological state, but nothing changes, right? So they dubbed this a no-go theorem. So we held off putting this on the archive. We did tell them about this work because we'd actually derived this independently quite a few months before. But actually, the status of that statement needs qualification within the context of the quantum Hall effect. Yeah?
The churn number depends on the initial state, right?
So that churn number depends on the initial state. So precisely, that's the paradox. You start in a topological state, it has nu equals one. You quench to this nu Hamiltonian, where in the ground state, it has nu equals zero. But you find that essentially, under the unitary evolution, you do not change that number. So what you've created is an excited state that if you compute this number, this invariant, it is the same as in your initial state, okay? In an infinite size system, okay? So they dubbed this a no-go theorem, and the question is, what does that mean, okay? What does it imply for the conductivity in this post-quench Hamiltonian? Is it topological? I suspect it's a little bit tricky, because what you've done is you've made an excited state that somehow preserves this index, but if it's an excited state, if this is exposed to the environment and there's some form of decoherence, you will presumably spoil that superposition, and so naively, it is less protected than your initial ground state that had a robust topological invariant, okay? So there's a kind of schizophrenic kind of interpretation of what's going on. On the one hand, you preserve this characteristic, but perhaps it's less robust because it's a property of this final excited state, okay? And so what we can see is that if we look at this problem on a finite size strip, then actually the edge currents equilibrate at late times, and they approach values that are very close to the equilibrium values of the post-quench Hamiltonian, in spite of the fact that in the infinite size, this index is actually preserved, okay?
Post-quench, there's no currents, right? You've got the trivial phase.
Okay, that's actually another subtle point, okay? So the problem is there are edge states in your spectrum, and there's a separate issue as to whether you have edge currents, okay? And the reason for the distinction is that if you imagine trying to compute the current, it's some kind of expectation value, in principle, that can have contributions from both bulk states and those edge states, okay? So paradoxically, what we find is that even in the topological phases, where naively you expect edge currents, okay? I think the technical statement is there are edge states, but there don't have to be edge currents. And in fact, we find examples where the edge currents vanish in the topological phases, okay? And there's actually some precedence for this, because if you look at the computation of the magnetization, okay, it's known that there's some regions of parameter space where this magnetization vanishes. So there's a distinction, I think, between edge states and observables that are properties of the edges.
So yeah. In this model, you have the nice property that the region where the baryon curvature is concentrated is also where the gap, right? That's also where the direct fermion
exists. Exactly,
is.
Yeah.
You could imagine somewhere deeper in the phase that you separated this so that the gap is smallest, not where most of the baryon curvature is concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
Would you then imagine, expect the churn number to be?
Yeah, very good. Okay, so let me give you two physical arguments for why this number is preserved. Okay, so the first is, how do you understand this churn invariant? Okay, so what I said is, you've got this Dirac Hamiltonian, and a Dirac Hamiltonian essentially describes a spin in an effective magnetic field. Okay, So what it says is that every point in K-space, you've got an effective magnetic field, which means your state is going to try and align itself along that field. Okay? So what it says is that in momentum space, your initial Hamiltonian describes a situation where you have some distribution of magnetic fields in K-space. Okay? And the idea is that each of those Dirac points will contribute some effective magnetic field. And so the question is, does this net magnetic field wind on the sphere or not? Okay? And so what you can check is that if you're in a topological phase, you have some net winding. If you're in a non-topological phase, you don't. Okay? And the two contributions from the Dirac points cancel out. Okay? So why is it preserved under a quench? It's preserved because what you do is you start from this initial topological object, you go to this post-quench Hamiltonian, which changes the magnetic field. Your spins precess in this new magnetic field, but they can't undo their winding. Okay? So that's one argument for why it should be preserved. To come back more explicitly to your question, if you don't use this Dirac fermion language, but just look at what happens to the time dependence of the Berry curvature, indeed, it's concentrated, as you said, at these places where you have the Dirac fermions. You can look at the time dependence of this. It's non-zero. So it says that, indeed, these spins are precessing non-trivially. But if you do the integral over the Brillouin zone, it vanishes. Okay? So this is some hint, then, that you get the intuition right from the Dirac fermion language. And if you just do this brute force computation for the Haldane model directly, it's still preserved. Okay? Okay. So let me, just in the interest of time, let me just skip the kind of questions related to the currents. And I'll just tell you physically in words about the dynamics of the edge currents, and I can always come back to it, okay? So the point is, you can define the current operator for this Haldane model, right? So a lot of the transparencies I skipped over were about defining this current operator carefully, checking that in equilibrium you get out what you expect. And as I said, there was a few surprises on the way because you discover that actually some of these currents actually vanish within the topological phase, okay? But what you can do is you can say, well, let's say I start in the topological phase, okay? So I have some non-vanishing edge state. I also have some non-vanishing edge current. And I ask, what happens if I abruptly change the Hamiltonian? Then what you find is you get some non-trivial oscillations, but your current eventually settles down to some steady state value. The red line is the ground state value of the final Hamiltonian, okay? So that deserves a little bit of qualification. The first is that you're performing a quench, so you naively expect your system to be in an excited state, okay? So that's the first thing, okay? Nonetheless, empirically, we find that the value of the current is very close to the ground state value, okay? So that's probably an accident of the numerology. It's probably just saying the effective temperature in inverted commas that actually governs the post-quench Hamiltonian is sufficiently small that actually on these graphs, you just can't see the difference between the ground state and the excited state, okay? In general, because this is actually a free theory, you expect that the mode occupation numbers will be conserved under unitary evolution. So actually, I should talk about some kind of generalized Gibbs ensemble where all of those occupation numbers are playing a role rather than just an effective temperature. But very crudely, I've excited the system, it's in an excited state. Empirically, though, it's pretty close to the final ground state expectation value. So this is showing two different quenches to the non-topological phase, and you can see that in both cases, it agrees with what you expect in equilibrium. And in addition, it's probably hard to see on this plot, but this has both circles and crosses that are coincident because we've done the simulation for n equals 30 and n equals 40. It says that the early time dynamics in this is insensitive to the width of my system, okay? It says we're probing the intrinsic dynamics of these edges, okay? So there's no finite size effect, okay? Where do finite size effects show up? They show up at later times because eventually your system is going to know that you've abruptly changed the Hamiltonian and that there's going to be some excitations going into the interior, and it's going to become aware of the fact that it's on a finite size width. And indeed, we can check that. Okay, so let me show you. If you ask what happens to these currents as a function of time, okay? What you can see is that at time t equals zero, you have these edge currents and you're gapped in this interior. As a function of time, there is some propagation into the interior. This propagation speed is precisely the speed of light I told you that the Haldane model has, is 3t over 2 h bar. And for the parameters we've chosen, this is basically 1.5. And so you see you've got light cone propagation of these edge states into the interior of the sample. Okay? So what does that mean? It means that at a time scale when these meet, beyond that, you're not going to be able to trust your finite size simulations to tell you about the intrinsic dynamics of the edges. Okay? It's still a physical effect in that if you have a finite size system, well, okay, there's something propagating into the interior and it meets the boundaries. And indeed, we can check that if we go to larger system sizes, this is n equals 20, n equals 30, n equals 40, we get resurgent oscillations beyond the time scale at which those two signals meet. Okay? So just to kind of emphasize, what it means is, in this example, we're pretty certain we've got the intrinsic dynamics of the edge states correct. You see that at early times, there's no finite size effects, and at late times, you see the finite size effects you ought to do, okay? Okay, so let me just kind of conclude the, yeah. Yeah, sure.
Back to the time dependence of the current.
Yeah.
So how does this saturation value depend on the strength of the quench?
The saturation value,
yes.
That in a sense doesn't. So that's related to the fact that what's plotted here is just the value of the ground state expectation value of the final Hamiltonian. Okay, so it's counterintuitive that there should be some dependence that you're alluding to. But let me just go back to the phase diagram. That quench for those edge states is for this specific quench where that solid line. So you start somewhere outside this region, you go somewhere here. The idea is you've made an excited state of the post-quench Hamiltonian. So what you should do is you should work out expectation values in that excited state. So in this case, so for that plot, we were going the other way. So we were going from the topological to the non-topological, but we've also done it the reverse way, and you get the same physics out, that your final state, okay, is numerically close to the ground state expectation value of the final Hamiltonian. But technically, I think you're correct, it should be some excited state of the final Hamiltonian, okay? But for numerical reasons, it's coming out close to the ground state value, because I think when you do these kind of quenches, unless you're maybe miles away from the phase diagram, which we've already checked as well, essentially you're not heating up the system very much.
Depend on how, so here you ramp up instantaneously?
We've done it for sweeps as well, okay? And you get the same physics. Actually, we've not checked the dynamics of the edge modes for sweeps. What we've checked is that in the bulk system, if you do a sweep, this churn index is preserved.
So say you start from the pink region and then go to very large gap trivial phase.
Up here. Yeah, we did that actually. Yeah. Let me check that probably. I'm not sure if I've actually got one of the plots. I'd have to check the numbers. So that was one of the early things we started to look at, because actually, if you start miles away in this trivial phase, you might imagine that you've got some control over the final state Hamiltonian. So we did check that. So this is for two different quenches from different initial states to the same final state, okay? And so what you see is that these agree pretty well, okay? So somehow, you know, put differently, your final state is the final state Hamiltonian. The purpose of the initial state was to cause an excitation of your final state Hamiltonian, okay? So this is why I'm saying that I think, although it's interesting that this index is preserved in an infinite system, okay, the purpose of the quench is to put you in an excited state of your final Hamiltonian, okay? So somehow some topological properties might be preserved, okay? But if you look at the dynamics of the edge state, I think it's the final Hamiltonian that governs thing, modulo the fact that you've got some memory of the initial condition by your effective temperature, in quotes.
But if it's finite, you expect that eventually the states at both edges will talk to each other and gap, or the current will just die.
But you see, that's what happens, right? So that's precisely what happens. So this dotted line is the time scale for the disturbances from those two edges to meet. Okay, they meet in the middle, and if you have a larger system, they meet at later times. Okay, beyond that time scale, you start to see resurgent oscillations in the edge currents, okay, which take you away from those ground state expectation values. Okay, so again, I think it's consistent with the fact that you're approaching the ground state value of the final Hamiltonian, or close to it, and at late times, eventually, indeed, you notice you're in a finite size sample and you perturb away again. Yeah.
Just probably a stupid question, but how is J n of t defined? Because it's non-zero the ground state of the non-topological.
No, so that's the subtlety, okay? So that took us off guard as well. So the point is, so I tortured my graduate student for at least 2 months, okay? It was probably outlawed by the Geneva Conventions. But the basic point was, he computed the edge currents in the system, and they vanished in the topological phase. And it's like, okay, how can this happen? You know you've got edge states. Surely there should be edge currents. And the point is, actually, I think they're distinct. So we have edge states in the final thing. In the initial Hamiltonian, we have no edge states, but we have edge currents, okay? And I think it's partly because there's actually a contribution to the edge currents that comes from the interior of the sample, okay, which somehow means that even though you've got no edge state, if you measure this current, there's some kind of contribution that comes from these kind of skipping interior orbits, okay? So if you look at what we computed these edge currents, okay? They vanish in the topological phase, okay? So this was a scan of the edge currents. So you see you've got an edge current going one way, an edge current going the other. It vanishes in the middle of this phase. You say, how can this possibly be? It turns out there's a symmetry argument that tells you it has to actually vanish in the middle of this thing. You can look at the symmetries of the Hamiltonian, symmetries of the current. It actually vanishes at this midpoint. And in fact, Marcus Riegel observed the same thing, that actually if you look at the structure of the edge modes, they're not completely chiral. Okay, they actually consist of counter-propagating modes which cancel precisely at pi over 2. And in fact, this had been observed not by looking at the edge currents, but very soon after the Haldane model was introduced, people working in band structure looked at the orbital magnetization, and what they found was that the orbital magnetization vanishes in the interior of these topological phases. And in fact, we've checked that it actually vanishes on a sinusoidal locus within the topological phase. So I think the point is there's a distinction between edge states and edge currents. Okay, because one is just a property of the Hamiltonian, the other is actually an expectation value that depends also, in a sense, on something going on in the bulk. Okay, so the special point. So it vanishes on this, on these lines, and on these sinusoidal loci in there. So we've got arguments for why it vanishes at pi over 2 and 3 pi over 2. Don't have an argument for why it vanishes. It's just a numerical observation that it vanishes on a perfect sinusoid.
Generically,
it doesn't. Okay. So generically, there's edge states and there's edge currents, and it's what you'd expect. Okay. So in this magnetic language, I think the authors of the band structure calculations argued that there's some diamagnetic contribution, I think, that comes from the interior, and so you probably have to be a little bit careful in how you think about the edge states. Okay. So there's some sine compensating values which accounts for this annihilation inside the topological phase. Okay, so let me just, because of the time, I'll conclude, but I'll just leave you with the kind of thing that we're working on with ADS-CFT. What I've shown you is you can look at the non-equilibrium dynamics of the edge states in this very simple problem. In 1 plus 1D, these edge states are conformal field theories, okay? Some non-trivial Luttinger liquid. A lot of the kind of experiments that were done on the non-equilibrium properties of these edge states in real quantum Hall devices was to look at noise, okay? There's a whole bunch of beautiful papers, when included, looking at noise in the edge states. Why do you want to look at the noise in the edge states? Well, because if you look at the average current, you can't tell the charge of your excitations. You don't know whether you've got a big charge moving slowly, small charge moving fast. If you look at the fluctuations, you see the discreteness of the charge. So what they do is they look at tunneling between edge states. You can see the tunneling current, the noise, depends on the charge of your carrier, and you can see fractional charge of the electron in real devices, okay? So this is what you get if in the Laughlin state it's E over 3. If you don't have non-trivial carriers, you'd get this line is clearly miles off. So the point is, what we're trying to look at is the noise in these gapless surface states using ADS-CFT, okay? And so I think this is one example where you can use the technology of strongly interacting gapless systems to get a handle on the non-equilibrium dynamics and the full set of noise fluctuations, okay? So what I'm going to talk about tomorrow is the fact that we've managed to do this for thermal transport between reservoirs. You can not only compute the average energy current, but also the entire distribution of fluctuations. And so what we're currently working on is to try and generalize that to include charge. And the hope is that we should actually be able to also make some contact with the quantum Hall literature that is used to determine the fractional charge of carriers in quantum Hall devices, okay? But that is definitely a story for another talk, okay? So I'll wrap up there.
Have you mapped the entanglement dependence, the time dependence of entanglement post-Clench?
No, and actually, I mean, so believe it or not, that was something that, in a sense, I was thinking about long before this thermal Clench, actually. So a long time ago, I had a chat with Marcus Muller in Trieste about trying to look at dynamics of entanglement entropy following the local Clench.
No, but this was, my question was for the churn.
For the whole day model.
That's right.
Yeah, no, so we have. But it's a free system, so it must be straightforward to compute.
Mm-hmm. And so what's the answer?
There's no subleading, it's just integer quantum Hall, right? So there's no subleading topological things or anything. It's just
it's area law at any time?
No, it'll be volume law.
Volume law, right?
Yeah, there'll be a growing volume law coefficient.
Right.
In equilibrium.
No,
post-Clench. Right, because you will make some bulk excitations, however weak a density, and that will set the volume law term in the entanglement energy.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll just see them.
But that's my point, is that you sort of entangle the system at, you know, all scales, essentially, post-Clench. So you would think that the currents could just not be too relevant because, you know, both sides of the system can talk to each other. Well, I guess there's this finite light of propagation effect you discussed.
Yeah, well, you look at the currents, you look at time t equals zero, you do the Clench, you just ask what happens to those currents, you see that there's kind of light cone propagation. I mean, to be honest, I actually just guessed that you would see that. I was actually quite surprised how cleanly it came out. I mean, it's a free theory, so actually that's probably the reason that you see these well-defined light cones. Okay, but still, it's a very clear signature, and it has the correct speed of light. Okay, so, you know, so there is some propagation to the interior. You see the reflections. So, you know, somehow maybe the entanglement entropy
reflects that process. I'm not entirely sure.
The probability breaking interactions to spoil this picture.
Well, here we don't. You mean because you've got this mass perturbation
and you've got time reversal symmetry breaking?
No, I'm just saying that you expect the same physical picture to hold, right? This light of speed of light propagation of the edge states.
Well, so this is for the Haldane model. In the Clench from the topological phase to the non-topological.
No, the other way around, but what interactions?
Okay, so
like out of Hubbard term or
so my guess is that you'll see something similar.
Yeah.
But we haven't analyzed that.
Yeah. So I mean, it's hard to do.
It's hard to do, right? So that was also why I was suggesting as well, right? I mean, you know, if you look at things like non-equilibrium dynamics, fractional quantum Hall, right? For 1+1D, you've got a hope of doing it. That's why everybody computed noise, because it's described by a lottage liquid, and you can just do everything, okay? So once you try and imagine that you've got far from equilibrium topological systems with, say, surface states or non-trivial interactions, unless it's in 1+1, actually there's not much you can do, right? Either numerically or analytically, okay? So this is why I think maybe ADS-CFT can offer some hope for some types of problems associated with the non-equilibrium dynamics of these gapless surface states, okay? Yeah.
Wouldn't, if it was interacting, shouldn't the, you do create some density of quasi-particles in the bulk, right? Wouldn't this edge that's kind of seeping into the bulk interact with them? Something be, would they quite, have quite, to meet each other and that's the way they would relax? Is that the only?
Quite possibly. I mean, okay.
So if you imagine what might eventually happen, okay, so good. So if you imagine just you had a 1D integrable model, you do a quench. Typically, these things don't thermalize because your mode occupations are preserved under unitary evolution, and so you end up with the GGE. If you have some interactions, if it preserves integrability, you expect something similar. If it destroys integrability, you would naively expect thermalization. Here, we just get repeated recurrent oscillations because it's not thermalizing, because it's a free theory, and we don't have any interactions. So one possibility is that if you looked at some interacting system, you might be able to see some signatures of thermalization, okay? Maybe you'd have to look at something like entanglement in some region so that the rest of the system acts like a bath, okay? So indeed, you might be able to see something like the settling down of these oscillations or the recurrent oscillations at late times.
So maybe to settle this issue, experiments would be useful to look at the edge state dynamics post-quench.
Yes, absolutely.
So either doing this or there's some obstruction.
Well,
so we sent an email just before we put this on the archive to Tillman. Actually, the lead experimentalist was going on vacation, okay? So he's going to write back next week, okay? So one possibility is a kind of simple thought experiment you could do is if you have some kind of tracer particle, you could imagine maybe a tracer particle gets carried along with this drift somehow, right? Because essentially, it's kind of wave propagation into the interior, okay? So that would be one way. There's also proposals to actually look at edge states in cold atoms, okay? It's kind of theoretical proposals, okay? So if any of those can be realized, then perhaps you can see this effect, okay? I mean, one thing that's useful about this is that you start off with the edge state, but what you would image is not the edge state, but maybe this propagation into the interior. So maybe that's actually a little bit easier, that you're not having to confine yourself to just kind of one row of atoms on the surface. There's some non-trivial interplay between the edge states and the interior, which might make this a little bit easier to map out.
I mean, the other thing is as well is that it also shows up indirectly in the magnetization, because the orbital magnetization is in a sense a function of the kind of circulating currents, okay? In a cold atom
setting, it might be harder to compute this magnetization because there's, you know, they're neutral atoms, okay? So maybe I can't really think about this as some magnetic moment, okay? So it needs something that kind of reflects the circulation in the system.
Okay, then let's thank Joe again.